Welcome to the Final Draft Podcast. My name's Andrew Popel. Today, I'm joined on the show by Luke Rutledge. Here on the Final Draft Podcast, we explore books, writing, and literary culture each week. There's a show broadcast on 2SER in Sydney. It's called Final Draft. And at Final Draft, we are dedicated to exploring Australian writing, whether it be a brand new debut author or one of those established names that you just know and love. These conversations are all about getting into the issues that drive the author's storytelling, a way to help you discover more from the books that you love, because these are the stories that make us who we are. And here at 2SER, we broadcast from the lands of the Gadigal people. I record on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. And I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands where we work. I want to pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, acknowledging that they are unceded lands and that there has never been a treaty made in this country. Now, today on the show, I am joined by a fantastic debut author. His name is Luke Rutledge, and we are going to be talking about his book, A Man and His Pride. It is set against the backdrop of the 2017 marriage equality postal vote, and it tells a story about identity, about understanding self and sexuality, and finding your community. I absolutely loved A Man and His Pride. So I'd love if you would join me in conversation to discover Luke Rutledge's A Man and His Pride.
G'day.
Hello. How are you, Luke?
Yeah, good. How are you?
I am.
It's Andrew.
It is Andrew, yeah. And how has A Man and His Pride out in the world been going? I've got to admit, I never know when things are actually in the world, but I think I've seen it at my local bookshop, so I know it's there.
Yeah, it's been out since, about two weeks now, since the very end of January. So, yeah, it's going really well. I'm only now starting to get some feedback from people who have read it, because obviously it takes people a while to read books. I'm getting some really lovely feedback, actually, just people saying they couldn't put it down. And it's interesting. I think I underestimated how jarring the character of Sean would be for people who haven't known a Sean before, you know. That's probably the most divisive thing about the book, whether people can get on board with Sean as a character or, you know, some people find him too unlikable, but anyway, so be it.
So this is going to come up later, but I also did a little radio spot on our breakfast program where we call it a book club, but it's just, instead of me interviewing, it's just me actually talking about my own thoughts on a book. So I did A Man and His Pride this week, and for me, the thing that I highlighted was, like, for the book to work, Sean has to work. But you don't have to love him. You don't have to hate him. You just have to be compelled by him. And yeah. I think that that's what makes this book amazing.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. And I guess, like, most gay readers probably would feel that way as well, because, as I said, like, I've had a lot of people say to me, I've known a Sean. Like, I had one guy the other day say, oh, he's such a prick, but I've known so many Seans in my life. But for perhaps non-gay readers, and this book is trying to reach as wide of an audience as possible, perhaps he's not a character that many people have seen before. So, just might find him a bit jarring and unlikable. But I agree with you. Like, I don't like characters that are just perfect and don't have any flaws. Like, who wants to read about that? And so long as you sort of, yeah, find him compelling enough that you want him to get better, then I think that that's the main thing. Yeah.
Oh my God. I have something I want to ask you, and I'm toying with asking you now while it's in the flow of the conversation, or trying to chuck it in the interview, but I think I might just ask you now. Basically just this idea of having known a Sean, because it felt to me like you were on the one hand, even through Sean's own eyes, you were painting him into a stereotype, and it was a stereotype he was quite comfortable with, because he loved the life that he had, or at least he did until the end of his relationship. I've forgotten whether it's Jack or Jake. That was just the best. That was my favorite. Just blow my mind.
Jake and Jacob.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Sean seems comfortable in his own stereotype, even as he is problematizing and changing. Like, because I never really saw that stereotype, because through Sean's eyes, he seems to be in this state of flux.
Yeah, and some people have said to me, like, oh, we've seen lots of Williams depicted in books and movies, but not so much the Shauns. I don't really know why that is, because they're definitely out there, and I've met quite a few in my time. It's funny, I never really thought about him as being a stereotype. I just kind of wrote a character that I sort of, I don't know, tried to make him as flawed as possible, I don't know. To be honest, I hadn't really thought too much about that.
It's interesting though, I didn't think of him as a stereotype until you were saying there. People were reflecting, oh, I've met a Shaun. And I mean, that just basically, that's, what is that anything other than a type? But for me, for me, it was kind of like, it was almost like there were moments when he was trying to reassure himself that he was the same hot, shallow grinder guy, even as he's like, I wouldn't even need to reassure myself if that wasn't changing right now, and that resistance to the change.
I think, yeah, because he can pass as a straight man, really, like he's a jock, and that's his biggest sort of, in his mind, his biggest asset, I suppose, like it, because he's got a lot of shame, obviously, and that's kind of how he deflects, I suppose, by passing by as a straight guy, really. And, you know, he's sort of afraid of anything, of anyone that's particularly effeminate, like the way that he interacts with William in the beginning, and William's obviously quite a flamboyant, loud and proud gay guy. I've met the Shauns that I've met, and maybe this is generalizing a little bit and simplifying it, but a lot of them, you know, they don't want to have anything to do with you if you do come across as being flamboyant and effeminate, because it taps in, I think, to their own shame and makes them uncomfortable and you know, puts them into the spotlight a bit more. Yeah.
All right, look, I need to acknowledge we're leaving a lot of gold in the sound check here. I'm just going to start the interview proper. Is that cool?
Yeah, and feel free to, whatever we've spoken about, just edit that into it.
All right, here we go. My name's Andrew Popel. It is my absolute pleasure to be welcoming to the show Luke Rutledge. Luke is a writer from Brisbane, and we are going to be talking about his debut novel. It is called A Man and His Pride. Luke, fabulous to have you here. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
We've already talked a little bit off air about A Man and His Pride, about your central character, Shaun, but people really need to get to know him before any of this is going to make sense. So if I may, until 3 months ago, Shaun had never even had a steady boyfriend. And now, a drawer full of fancy undies and an ill-advised moment with a bottle of mouthwash have him thinking he might never again. Shaun's been out for years, and relationships, let alone marriage, are not things he sees in his future. But it feels like the whole world is talking about gays getting married, while all Shaun wants is his six-pack back. When Shaun meets William, though, he discovers a new world, one of long-term relationships and dogs that you call your kid. It's a million miles from Shaun's life, but it's got him wondering if it's possible there's more to life than grinder and hookups. Shaun's finally looking to the future, but inevitably that means he'll have to come to terms with the past. So look, I feel like I teased some really fun moments there without, you know, going too deep in. That's our job here.
That was a really cool intro. I kind of wish you'd written the blurb, to be honest. Should put all that on the blurb.
I've already done a little spot on Brekkie talking about A Man and His Pride, and it did have a different little synopsis. And I feel like there are so many aspects of A Man and His Pride that, depending on the reader, depending on their life experience, depending on just how they feel when they pick up this book, they're probably going to hone in on and maybe make a little bit of, you know, their reading experience. I want to maybe try and hit all of these points. Let's see how we go. Because I mean, I love the way you built up a community, you build up a scene and a history through A Man and His Pride. But one thing that I'm really conscious, and I don't want to leave any of that out, but I just want to focus on Shaun for a bit, because this story hangs on Shaun being a character that we can get involved with. I don't want to say we have to love him. I don't want to say we have to hate him. We've already talked a little bit about this. We need to be compelled by Shaun. I was compelled by Shaun. I'm curious though, where did you meet Shaun? And did you feel any pressure on him having to carry this story?
So as I said before we were chatting, I have met Shauns before. So I back in my single days and going on dates and things, you know, I did meet men, gay men who they were out as gay, but it struck me that they weren't particularly proud about it. They just seemed to have a lot of baggage and internalized shame that they hadn't worked through before and sort of had the walls up. And, you know, anyone who's been on Grindr for 5 minutes or maybe even 5 seconds will have seen, you know, these blank profiles or just pictures of bare torsos with the word discreet. And I guess the writer in me has always wondered about that, you know, wondered, oh, why are you discreet? Like, what's going on there? So, yeah, I didn't sort of have any one specific person in mind when creating the character of Sean, but I guess that's sort of where it came from. And then, as I said, the writer in me just kind of makes up the rest of it, I suppose. So his background and his trauma, which you alluded to there, it is completely made up. But I guess, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I don't purport to understand exactly the minds of how these men's minds work. But yeah, I was just interested in kind of exploring that grey area between being in the closet and being out and proud. Mm. And I think so much, you know, gay literature and movies that we watch and TV shows, they either tend to focus on that sort of turbulent coming out period and the time leading up to it, or the other end of the spectrum where you've got, you know, gay people and they're, you know, living their best lives essentially. Mm. So I was interested in looking at that messy middle where I think a lot of that growth actually happens. And, you know, perhaps we haven't really seen those stories depicted as often. So that's kind of why I was drawn to that. Yeah.
Yeah. I liked that you were really emphasizing the fiction of this fictional novel. And I know that for many readers, there is this, I don't know if it's a tendency, I don't know if it's a desire to start to really identify the author with their characters. It's 2 weeks old. This is still a baby book, but I know you've gotten a little bit of feedback. Has anyone been asking you, are you a Sean? Are you a William? Are you a Jacob?
Yeah, it's something that my agent warned me that would be like the number one question that people would have for you. And yeah, the honest answer is I am neither William or Sean, but I mean, any writer will tell you that inevitably, you know, a part of yourself finds its way onto the page. You can't really avoid that. Just your voice, I suppose, and the way that you think about things just inevitably makes it into the story. So, yeah, but I'm neither. And, you know, unlike Sean, when I came out, I was met with nothing but love and support from my family and friends. So my journey to, you know, reach that point of feeling proud about who I am and as a gay man, it was a lot more straightforward for me than Sean's journey. Having said that, you know, like before I came out, you know, I spent all of my teens and a lot of my early 20s in denial and, you know, trying to convince the world and myself that I wasn't gay. Don't know how successful I was with convincing people. But, you know, so I still had a lot of shame that I had internalized for a long period of time that I had to work through. But, you know, when you come out and you have a network of people around you that are nothing but supportive, it definitely makes that next transition period much more straightforward. Yeah.
I felt like as I read in the book, aspects of Sean and Williams, and we haven't properly introduced William yet. Well, we'll get to that. But as Sean and William grow in their friendship and talking about their own stories, even this need as William sort of talks a little bit about how his sort of coming out story is fairly normal and fairly untraumatic. Just even that need, it felt to me this need to highlight whether it was traumatic or not traumatic speaks to the broader sort of social setting where we assume trauma and need to, you know, kind of identify when it's not traumatic. Is that a fair comment about kind of the broader social milieu of those stories?
I think so. And for Sean as a character, like he grew up not having seen any other experience of coming out, other coming out stories that may be more positive. You know, he's quite deliberately avoided any sort of connection with other people, gay people in particular. But so he's never seen any kind of real world examples of what a healthy relationship looks like. And when I say relationship, I don't just mean romantic, but also friendship as well. So when he meets Sean and he meets some of Sean's friends and starts to see these examples of, you know, what a healthy relationship can look like for a gay couple, that's when he sort of starts to have his eyes opened a little bit. But up until that point, he's just never really sort of seen any examples of that before. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Before we get to the loved up relationship side of things, I want to come back to the broader story. It's Brisbane, it's 2017, and you paint a picture of a dating scene that Sean is immersed in, and kind of by his own admission, it's pretty shallow. It's also a scene. So when Sean meets William, he's a nurse. He is a, you know, nice, settled, stable guy. But William wants to get into this scene. He wants to get outside his comfort zone. He wants to see what he perceives that he's been missing out on. What was it like for you trying to depict the complexity of that scene of dating and hookups that are both, I guess, on the surface superficial, but they're also highly important to people's worlds? Like this is Sean's world and so much of his identity.
Mm. Yeah. One of the things that I did set out to do with the book was to depict the gay dating scene in a perhaps a more realistic, maybe less sanitized way than what we're used to seeing, particularly in mainstream culture, I think. Because you know, it's not all parties and glitter and rainbows and dancing and singing and all the rest of it. Like, it can be those things, and often it is. But there is another side to it, and I think, you know, when you're talking about a marginalized community that is made up of people, you know, many of them have gone through their own traumas and often rejection. And I think that those things sort of find their way into the culture of a community. And so, you know, I do think that there is a lot of emphasis on body image in the gay community that I sort of wanted to hone in on a little bit. There's almost, you know, some people can be just so obsessed with what they look like. And Sean is definitely that sort of superficial person initially when we meet him. I think, you know, there's a lot of toxic masculinity in the gay community. I've met men who don't want to have anything to do with you if you sound effeminate, or, you know, if you're too flamboyant, then, because that sort of reflects on their own shame in a way. Mm. It taps into that. And then, yeah, like there is this more kind of, I guess, promiscuous side of the gay dating scene. And I'm talking specifically about Grindr here. And, you know, I'm not here to judge Grindr at all. Like, I think it's a wonderful thing for men who, you know, want to have those experiences and explore themselves. But like any tool, it can be abused as well. So if Grindr is the only way that you're making those connections with people, fleeting connections, then that perhaps might not be the healthiest thing. So, yeah, I wanted to explore some of these things and just put some of my observations that I'd made over the years of dating and being on the scene in a book. I don't know if there's really anything that in particular that I was trying to say about all of that. I was just interested in showing it in a story, but also kind of doing it in a way that's still fun. Like, I don't want to cast this dark shadow over the gay dating scene and, you know, say that it's all terrible or whatever, but I wanted to have a bit of fun with it as well and bring some humor in.
Yeah.
And so, can you hear my dog squeaking his toy right now?
It's not coming up on the microphone, okay. But I love that it's happening. I was getting.
I told you it would happen.
Hey. Oh, look, I was.
I've got it.
I was getting in the doorway. I was getting stink eye from one of my cats. Like, what are you doing? You're on the thing again. Okay, fine. You're
not paying attention.
Not paying attention.
Oh, Rufus, give me another 20 minutes.
I want to acknowledge you were talking there about a depiction of the scene and a stereotype of gay men. And look, I probably should acknowledge we are speaking at the beginning of World Pride, and for the next 17 days, it is going to seem a whole lot like the gay community is a lot of glitter, streamers, and color. And it was so interesting to me the way Sean's world kind of opened up. There's Sean and William. But as their friendship grows, Sean, he's coming to the realization that there are so many ways to be a gay man. He sees William in the aftermath of a 3-year relationship. He meets some of William's friends who are, and we haven't come to this aspect of the story yet, who are engaged but can't be engaged because they can't get married, except we have the backdrop of the marriage equality postal vote happening. It felt like both obvious and surprising, given how immersed we are in Sean's world, that he would be surprised by this, you know, that there is a different way to be in relationships. Were you highlighting here the way these stereotypes can work, that even for Sean, the stereotype of hookups and being that sort of man in his 20s, like he hadn't considered these other possibilities?
Yeah, I don't know if it's more that whether it's he didn't consider them, but it's more he thinks that he doesn't deserve them, and that sort of ties back in with his trauma, which I won't go into because it is a spoiler. But at the beginning of the book, you know, we see Sean reflecting on when he came out when he was 19, and he did it with a sense of like an admission of defeat almost, rather than an act of bravery or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, when he came out, he did so kind of assuming that it meant having to give up certain things, such as having a monogamous relationship, getting married, having, you know, starting his own family. And, you know, these are all things that he just has not seen before. And I think that that's quite a deliberate thing on his part, that he's not really ever explored that side of himself. But, you know, it was important for me in a very deliberate decision to open the book with him having just come out of a relationship, as fleeting and disastrous as it was, because it shows that, you know, that is actually deep down what he wants. He wants to love and to be loved in return. But it's also, I think, the thing that he is determined not to have. And that all just sort of ties in with the fact that he doesn't think that he is deserving of those things. Yeah, which is kind of sad, really.
it really is. And I was really struck. I was really struck by the way that he does. I mean, it's almost like his body knows that he deserves these things and he's unconsciously seeking them out. Like, again, without sort of diving into spoilers, the way he has a very fraught relationship with his mother, but also seeks out almost a proxy relationship in that loving way. And yeah, again, I don't want to fly too close to the sun with spoilers here.
No, that's okay. But yeah, so it was also a very deliberate decision when I was creating his character to surround him with these other characters that were just basically not very nice to him. And it's a very deliberate decision on Sean's part to keep these people in his life. So you've got the mother who, you know, he has a bit of a fraught relationship with, as you said. She's not very nice to him. And I think most people would probably cut ties with their mother if they were treated in that way. And yet he does still maintain that relationship with her. He visits her regularly and mows her lawn and cleans her house and stuff. You know, then you've got his best friend, Abby, who, you know, their friendship is quite shallow as well. And she has a lot of resentment towards him and is quite passive aggressive. And yet that is, he chooses to keep her in his life. And then the third person is his boss, Sonia, who is just an outright homophobe and borderline, you know, it's almost workplace discrimination. And yet he chooses to keep working for this person. And I think, again, that just ties into the fact that he's holding on to a lot of guilt about something in his past. And it's almost like he's trying to punish himself in a way. Like he's determined to not let go of those things because it's almost like it's a constant reminder that he's just not worthy. And what he really needs in his life is some positive reinforcement and some actual healthy relationships with people. And that's where William comes into it. So, yeah.
He needs, and it's so immediate that Sean just needs someone to build him up. I mean, it strikes me, it would be so interesting to introduce someone to Sean halfway into the book, because as soon as he's back into his gym routine and he's feeling very happy and very proud of his body, I feel like it's almost unrecognizable from the Sean of the first few pages, who is toying with this idea of settling, and suddenly he's jerked into reality. And just the way he can look down on himself and metaphorically and physically look down on himself. And I don't think you can lose that much tone in 3 months that he was probably doing all that badly, but just how far he had slipped from himself and just the loathing that he heaped on himself at that point.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't really know where it came from. He was a lot worse in earlier drafts, to be honest, and I think he was a lot more unlikable, and my publisher sort of worked with me a bit to, I guess, tone him down a little bit and bring out some of his more redeeming qualities a bit earlier on. And because, you know, as I said before, one of the pieces of feedback that I'm getting from people is how jarring they are finding Sean initially. Everyone's saying, oh, you know, he's really unlikable in the beginning, but I'm starting to get to like him now. And for me, I think I'd underestimated just how jarring a character like Sean would be for perhaps a lot of non-queer readers who haven't seen that sort of character very often, particularly not in mainstream sort of culture, I guess. So, but for me as the writer, I mean, I've known Sean's before, not very well, but just those initial kind of reactions you get from people, it's interesting. Yeah.
That's so interesting too. I mean, I loved him immediately. And then he went through this period where I'm like, oh, maybe you're getting a little less likable. But one thing you mentioned, Abby, you mentioned Sonia. There is broadly, and even, I mean, maybe even Ryan fits into this a bit as well. So Ryan is William's ex, or current, or it's complicated. there seems to be a theme that mirrors Sean's of people whose behavior is questionable at best, homophobic and awful at worst, but everyone has a sort of an instigating event. And as a reader, we have to toy with this idea of they are being terrible. I don't like the way they are treating this person, usually Sean. But also there's a reason, and Sean sees a reason, and that's why Sean thinks he deserves it. And how we reconcile behavior stemming from a traumatic event.
Yeah, and actually one review that I have had actually, which was not a particularly positive review, but this person said that they just couldn't get on board with Sean as a character all the way through. And then there is this kind of reveal about him at the end, and she sort of felt like it came too late, you know, which I sort of thought was interesting, but there you go. Everyone has their opinion. But yeah, so he does have this other side to him that is gradually revealed and hinted at throughout the novel. But, you know, just on what you're saying about, you know, so many people are unlikable, I'm getting a lot of that feedback as well from people, but maybe that just means that I am more drawn to writing characters that are unlikable because I find them more interesting. I don't know. I enjoy reading scenes where people are kind of being awful to each other in a way, and it's more interesting than reading where everyone's just getting along like a house on fire, you know.
we thrive on drama, you know.
Yeah.
And this reviewer, I don't know if they're a listener, but I bet they also complain that Agatha Christie waits till the end to tell us who the killer is. Yeah. What's the point of a reveal? Yeah,
perhaps, yeah.
I want to take a little bit of a sideways step here, because Sean's story is compelling. It stands on its own. It strikes me that this story could have looked very different in a different time, but one feature that needs to be acknowledged is that it is set against the backdrop of the final weeks and the final days of the Marriage Equality Postal Survey, which, I mean, I think actually reading this book reminded me of how zeitgeisty that moment was from a sort of a cultural level. Why did you want to highlight this period through the narrative?
I have been asked this question a bit, and I wish that I had a more intellectual answer to give you to this, to be honest. The truth of the matter is that the idea to set it during the plebiscite was an idea that just kind of came to me in the shower one day. I had been planning the book for a couple of weeks and hadn't started writing it yet. But once I made that decision to set it during that period, the story did come a lot more easily to me. It sort of seemed to provide a natural kind of structure and arc to the story, because I knew that I wanted to write a book that would be ultimately uplifting and hopeful. And of course, we all know how the marriage equality survey turned out. So it gave it a natural kind of structure. But, you know, looking back, I can now see, obviously, you know, setting it during what was a very turbulent time in Australia's, you know, fight for equality fits in well with Sean's character and the journey that he is going on. You know, that the two seem to kind of echo and complement each other a lot. But honestly, I actually wasn't thinking too much about all of that when I was writing it. It just seemed like, you know, this character is going on this journey of finding his pride, and that is kind of the main theme of the book. And it just seemed to fit in well with setting it during this period, which, you know, we all remember, it wasn't that long ago. It was such a weird and wacky time. And I could see that there would be things that happened during that time that I would be able to put into the story to maybe make it more relevant, or just kind of ground it in a period of history that we can all sort of remember. And yeah, I think it just sort of helped to elevate the story and bring out those themes of pride and shame and all the rest of it. Yeah.
It also created a really interesting tension, as you point out. Everyone reading the book knows how that story ends effectively. But we don't know how Sean's story is going to end. We don't have that guarantee of, you know, a big, terrific, you know, well, maybe not as overwhelming as we would have wanted, overwhelming positive yes.
Yeah, and you know, I was 17. Sorry, I was during 2017 when we had the plebiscite. I had been out for quite a long period of time, so I was you know, quite comfortable in my sexuality by that point. And so, you know, a lot of the negative rhetoric that was going around from the No campaign at that time, I was able to just kind of deflected, I suppose, and not really think too much about it. But of course, you know, a lot of people living during that time, perhaps younger queer people who may not have been at that point of acceptance yet, it was a really awful time, I suppose. And I remember speaking to a friend of a friend who worked at Lifeline at the time, and she said to me that they had noticed a definite spike in the number of calls that they were getting from, you know, young queer people who were distressed about what they were hearing and that kind of thing. So I think it's easy to forget that side of things, really. And so, you know, and that kind of, I think, helped to add, as you say, a bit of narrative tension to the book as well. Yeah.
So there's a moment where Sean's having a dinner party with William and his friends. And as the group discuss the marriage equality postal vote, someone comments about how it shouldn't be so that so many non-queer people get to have a say in whether they get to have a fundamental right like marriage. It was a really interesting point that you didn't sort of go out of your way to hammer home, but it was sort of like dropping a pin in the middle of a quiet room. It really echoed for me. Can you talk a little bit about that idea?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the main... Sorry, my dog has found another squeaky toy.
No worries. I love this.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the main things that I remember from that campaign, was just the fact that we didn't have to have it. It didn't need to happen. It was, and the main strategy of the No campaign, I think, was that enough people just wouldn't be bothered to turn out to vote, really. Like, we... From the beginning, it was never a campaign about persuading people to vote yes. In many ways, that debate had already been kind of going on for years and decades even, and in many sense had already been won. But it was always, you know, there was always this real danger that just not enough people would turn out to vote. And when you're talking about and not enough people turning out to vote. You're talking about most people who just kind of sit in the middle, who just don't really care about marriage equality. And yeah, you're right. Like they all get to have a say. But if, you know, it would have been terrible if just not enough people cared about it, that they just didn't bother to vote. And then that could have sunk the outcome. So I don't know, just the injustice of it all. And it was really just a political tactic to kick the can down the road, essentially, and get it off the agenda. Because, you know, all the opinion polls at the time pointed to the fact that most Australians wanted marriage equality, but our politicians just, you know, couldn't be bothered to do their jobs, basically, and pass a bill that would have resolved it in a day, you know?
Yeah. We have a pretty bad history in this country of, I guess the large middle majority, conservative majority, demanding their say in the rights of marginalized or just smaller groups.
And it's so wrong. Like, you know, I can't think of too many other examples where, you know, when we've wanted to give a minority group a right that the rest of us all enjoy, that we go out to the entire population and basically say, what do you think? Should we do this or not? Like it shouldn't happen. Like that's not the kind of society that we want to live in. Some things you know are right, and that's when it's just up to the politicians to do their job basically and get it done.
We've talked about shame a bit in the conversation so far, and look, William's ex, we've mentioned Ryan already, he's a bit of a dick. At one point, he takes a shot at Sean with a comment about gay men. I think he sort of refers to them as gay men like Sean, who enjoy hookups and are on Grindr, having shame. It's all about their shame. Ryan's being nasty, but it's also true that we live in a society that still stigmatizes members of the LGBTQIA+ community. Shame's a real emotion that people have to deal with, even when it's not of their own doing, even when it's put on them by other people. We've already touched on this quite a lot, but like what sort of broadly did you want to highlight about shame through Sean's story?
Maybe not so much about shame, but more pride. Like, well, since writing the book, I've been thinking a lot about pride and shame and all these ideas. And I think one thing that I've realized or concluded maybe is that for most people, I think your pride is something that you take for granted. It's for me, the ultimate form of pride is where you don't really have to think about it. It's just kind of normalized for you. It's just part of your DNA. You know, I don't walk around every day thinking, oh, I'm such a proud gay man, you know. I'd be a bit concerned if I did, but, you know, it's just kind of part of my personality and my DNA now. But, you know, none of us are born feeling proud of who we are. It is something that everybody has to learn at some point along the way. And I think for LGBT people in particular, particularly those who have spent a portion of their life in the closet feeling ashamed of who they are, your pride is something that you have to almost actively go out and find. And so, you know, it's not something that happens overnight, and it's certainly not something that happens as soon as you come out of the closet. So I guess it was more just I was wanting to highlight the journey, I guess, that a lot of gay people, LGBT people have to go on to find their pride, because it's, you know, if we've spent a period of our life where we've been told we're not good enough, or we're somehow, you know, our sexuality is something to keep hidden or be ashamed about, then you do have to spend a bit of time after you come out sort of untangling some of those messages that you've internalized for a period of time. So, yeah, I guess that would probably be the main thing I was trying to get across.
Yeah. And thank you for calling me that because of course that flip of the shame is the pride. And the only reason Ryan's comments land for Sean is that he is still on that journey. He is still discovering his pride. I'm going to ask you a question. You're probably going to get asked a lot. It feels very softball and obvious, but also important. As you know, we're at the beginning of World Pride in Sydney, but you know, happening in first time in the Southern Hemisphere. You've reflected on a story that's only 6 years ago, where it felt like, you know, this fundamental right was just so at risk. Do you have any reflections on like what you've seen change in those 6 years, what you haven't seen change that were just like, come on, get onto this?
I think there's probably more visibility now, even in the last 6 years, in terms of gay characters in movies and TV shows and books. I mean, the fact that I can write this kind of book and actually get it published, I mean, maybe 10 years ago it might not have been picked up. I don't know. But, yeah, just talking about World Pride, I mean, I don't think you can underestimate the importance of visibility of, you know, our community in the mainstream. Mm. You know, when I think back to when I was in the closet, and as I said before, I spent all of my teens and my early 20s in denial. And, you know, I came from a household where it wasn't homophobic. Like, my parents are nothing but supportive. And I always knew that everyone in my life would be nothing but supportive when I came out. And yet somehow that just didn't seem to help me at all with overcoming my own shame. Mm-hmm. And I've since then thought a lot about, well, where the hell did it come from and what was that about? And I think it all just comes down to visibility. You know, growing up, I didn't have TV shows and movies and books that depicted in the mainstream these kinds of characters and that explored these sorts of themes. And I think now, you know, there's so many YA novels out there that are, you know, got all these positive messages for young questioning people. And, you know, we're living in a time of shows like Sex Education and you know, I don't know, Love, Simon, Heartstoppers, Heartbreak High, all those sorts of stories where we're starting to see, like, if you don't have to depict gay lives to be depressing and set in the AIDS epidemic, you know. You know, we're starting to tell more of these positive stories. So I think that's a wonderful thing. And yeah, hopefully that continues. Yeah.
I love that. I love, partly because we're a book show and that you've made it. Yes, the stories are being told. That's what I love to hear. But thank you. Thank you so much on that reflection, Luke. And thank you so much for your time discussing A Man and His Pride. It is a wonderful book. And I think one thing that's come through is that everyone has their own journey falling in love with Sean, which really, like, it mirrors his own journey falling in love with himself. And that for all the other reasons, is people should get out and discover it. Luke Rutledge is the author of A Man and His Pride. Thank you so much for today, mate.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your questions. Very good questions.
Cheers. Thank you so much to everyone for joining us today. That is all from my conversation with Luke Rutledge. Luke's new book is called A Man and His Pride. It's out now from Penguin. Go get it wherever you get your books. Now, Final Draft is recorded on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. There are so many more books to come. There are so many to discover. If this is your first time on the podcast, have a look at our back catalogue and also subscribe. It means a new conversation every week. If you are enjoying the show, if you've loved today's episode and you want to help people find it, click like. Maybe leave a comment. Tell us what you think. Did you love Luke's book? Did you love that conversation? It is a way for more people to find this show. My name is Andrew Popel. I'd love to hear from you at FinalDraft2SER on the social media, and I will be back next week with more incredible conversations from Australian authors. Till then, I wish you happy reading. Bye now.